If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today from Romeus Gold we have the President, Stephen Barriga, joining us as our guest. Stephen, welcome. How are you?
I'm great, thank you, Mark. Appreciate you having me on today.
Indeed, yes, good to be talking to you. Kenny, how are you?
Yep, I'm all good, Mark, and it's good to catch up, Stephen. We've had the pleasure of meeting before, and I'm sure we'll cover that in the podcast in the next 30, 40 minutes. But no, it's been too long. We should have done this a couple of years ago.
Well, I'm glad we're getting the opportunity to chat today, that's for sure.
Definitely. And where is it you're calling from today? I know it's Canada, Stephen, but...
Yeah, I'm based in Toronto, it's a beautiful day here, 30 degrees, humid, muggy. It's typical Toronto weather in the summertime.
Yeah.
And we're in the aircon, and with a newborn at home, we're trying to stay as cool as we can.
Yeah, it's a big upheaval for you because it's your first, isn't it?
It is. It's quite amazing. We're soaking up every minute of it.
Yeah.
Who knew you could love a little human so much? It's absolutely wonderful. We're absolutely enthralled, and little Ollie's doing great.
Good stuff. And what's quite bizarre, Stephen, I think we are exactly the same age, and you're just welcoming your first child into the world. And I just found out last week that, you know, I'm going to be welcoming a grandchild into the world. So it makes me feel really old, so it does now. Definitely.
We all have our own paths, don't we, Ken?
Yeah, well, this is what this podcast is about, is to tell us your path and how you got there, and, you know, and we'll come to that in a minute. But we've done a lot of these podcasts, Stephen, you know, and the reason we do these is because we believe that people invest in people. And I'm sure you've done, you know, dozens and dozens of interviews in your career, and people will never ever ask you about the projects, you know, and what the news flow is going to be, but nobody ever asks you, you know, about you, you know, what your past is, you know, what was your successes, failures, you know, what made you get into the mining space, you know, did you fall into it, was it a career path you chose, you know, so we're looking for you to tell us your sort of life story. You know, you can go back as far as you want, you can go back to childhood, you know, where you were brought up, you know, how you get into the space, education. You know, it's really up to you. Probably, you know, for the next 10, 15 minutes, you can just tell us all about yourself. And, you know, if there's any interest in myself and Mark, I'm sure there'll be loads that's interesting, Stephen. But I'm sure we'll jump in if there's anything we want to focus on. But really, the floor's yours for as long as you want.
Well, I appreciate it. I guess I've got a bit of an eclectic background. I've been working in this business for 15 plus years now, mm-hmm. being the natural resource business. I'm not simply mining exploration, but, you know, I've spent some time on the offshore oil and gas, onshore oil and gas. In fact, my first foray into this world was, you know, starting a small merchant bank with four business partners 15 years ago. And our first projects were in Africa. And mm-hmm. being the youngest on the totem pole without family and significant other, I was the one who upped the passport right away, and it wasn't 2 weeks later I found myself on a plane right to Africa for the first time, and from that point forward, I was in Africa for better part of 6 months of the year for a number of years. And our first business was in West Africa, in Mali and Burkina Faso, and mm-hmm. we started a company growing sunflowers. And then we're going to take that sunflower oil, seed and to turn it into oil. We put a world class pressing machine into a small little town in, called Leo in the Burkina Faso, and we started producing sunflower oil. And that was the very first deal I did in Africa. And from that point on, working and in that particular case, by the way, you know, we had thousands of out farmers that we worked with, and subsistent farmers, and you know, you try and do something that helps their lives along, and allows you to make a little bit of a buck along as well, and have an impact. And that was really the focus of the type of business I wanted to be in. I had every intention of trying to apply that type of a model to everything I've done since, and in various ways I think I've succeeded. I'd be the first to say I've had some epic wins and some epic failures. I think that's all part of the process of growing and learning as you go. And as I said at the beginning, I've had such an eclectic go at my career since, I guess, you know, graduating from school back in 98 and starting off in the finance side and working in the brokerage industry for a few years and taking an abrupt turn and getting into small politics on the federal side in Canada, and then moving there to communications and government relations and working with some of the world's best outfits on the communications and government relations side. And then eventually, as I said, starting into the resource side of things in a very non-traditional way. I guess, you know, I could have aimed to be a director of communications or corporate development right out of the gate with a junior or within the system of the senior system. Mm-hmm. But instead, I really always had this urge to work on projects and see them from start to finish and scratch that itch that I would have to building things from scratch. And I had absolutely amazing experiences all the way through. I mean, Africa is one of the most beautiful continents, and I've had the good fortune of traveling around the world now, and the context of working in Africa, I think, is applicable across the line. I don't think you say you work in West Africa, the French Africa, or you work in East Africa, or South Africa, Central Africa. I've visited and worked in many, many countries across the continent now, and there's just a general, I think, appreciation that I have for the culture and the people, and it's wild.
Yeah, I think what's key with Africa is that you've got to build that relationship with the people, because you ultimately you've got to engage with them and the local tribes to make everything work and, you know, to get everything signed off, etc.
It's true. It's true, Kenny. And you know, I guess I took that concept a little bit to the extreme when I started a company called Rakai Resources in Uganda. I did this, a private company. I started it actually as a partnership with a non-for-profit organization based out of Canada. And I gave them 50% of the company right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. And the model was based on the idea that easier to give away half of your company when there's no value to it, but the extreme value that bringing professional social development expertise to the table early on in the conversation was invaluable to me. Mm-hmm. So we looked at a model that simply didn't exist, and I couldn't help but you look at the world of our business of exploration or the resource sector in general, and all too often, it seems like that conversation, as you mentioned, was an afterthought. I think the world has changed significantly in the past 5-10 years, ESG principles being a priority and the mandated Canadian mandated priority now for our sector. It's wonderful to see, but prior to that, it was social you know, corporate responsibility, CSR programs. And it was an afterthought. The majors were spending time on building tools and tens of millions of dollars were going to it. And you just didn't really understand what the net benefit was to the people on the ground, from my perspective, at least.
Yeah.
So, you know, I started Rakai Resources. I gave half the company away. And then combined, we agreed to give a percentage of the ownership to the actual community where the assets we had acquired lived. Mm-hmm. So we gave 5% of the company into the name of the local community. And that whole model, I think there was a significant appreciation of that model that was achieved. And, you know, as a result of starting Rakai Resources, I was asked to present at the United Nations, and probably the single most important moment of my short career. Was presenting at the UN and at the Intergovernmental Forum of Mining, Metals, and Sustainability, and telling the all the delegates that were representative of all the countries in the world in front of me, with simultaneous translation happening and everyone having their little earpiece in this forum, in this format. It was unbelievable. And after I finished my presentation, got a very significant ovation from the group, because the model was so different. And then the Ugandan delegation stood up and he screamed out, "You're Ugandan from today on, Stephen. Come sit with us." And he wanted me to sit down at the table with them. And it was, you know, it's still to this day, when I tell that story, I get goosebumps and I get pretty emotional, because it felt like we really were trying to achieve something above and beyond money making. And yeah, who's kidding who? I want to make money. I want my shareholders to make money, but I also want the people on the ground who are affected by our business to see benefit.
Yeah,
and have a seat at the table. And that was really what the goal was. And God, you know, we worked closely with UNICEF to build interesting models to try and communicate with the local community in northern Uganda. And unfortunately, I ran out of money, which on the private side happens. You know, it was a tough time in the marketplace to raise capital for private deals. And I only had so much I could put into it, and we had limited shareholders. And company still exists, but right now without assets. But the model itself, I think, was groundbreaking, and it was something I'm very proud of. And it actually introduced me to my previous employers, which was Anchor Resources. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went from working in a post-conflict country like Uganda to working in a post-conflict country in Cambodia. So from a political perspective, and from a, from that bigger picture perspective, I had a really good sense of how to engage in community and engage in understanding of historical realities. And then I had met the founders, Mike and Delaine Weeks, through that whole process of presenting at the United Nations. And eventually we just got along so well. They said, "Can you come over and work with us?" And eventually, you know, 6 years passed, and I ended up becoming the CEO of that company. And we did some great work on the ground, and I still think they have fantastic assets. But my life was changing, and we were focusing on family and focusing on trying to stay closer to home. So decisions were made, having now being at the helm of a company that has North American based assets, I forgot what it was like to be able to fly to my to property and. In less than 10 hours, as opposed to a 24-hour turnaround at minimum, sometimes a lot more than that, to get out to Africa or to get out to Cambodia. It's really nice to be able just to fly out to BC or fly up north to Ontario or down to Nevada.
Yep.
And this is, it's been a very good transition for me. I'm really excited about the new opportunities that I'm working on. And I think that every step along the way that I've had in my career has taught me a little bit more about who I am and what it is I like to do, and what I do well and what I don't do well. And I think an eclectic background like that isn't a bad thing.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, the first time I met you, Stephen, was at a conference as well. I wouldn't say it was the UN conference. You said it was your most important conference. Let's call this one the second most important. But no, it was a networking event in Bangkok. And I don't think you remember too much about the next couple of days, Stephen. After that, I think you we went out in the town, and I think maybe because I'm a seasoned Scottish drinker, I think I maybe just we had too much drink that night. But no, I think it was about night time the next day before you kind of surfaced. So you did. It was it was a good night out, but no, it was a great event. And I mean, we just clicked right away. You know, we did,
Kenny. And a lot of the participants at that event, at that networking event, I've kept in touch with over the years. And I think it was a great opportunity to expand the network and for me to meet a lot of the groups that you actually are quite connected to. So I appreciated that networking event significantly.
Believe it or not, it was nearly 5 years ago, I think. I mean, at least four.
I know. Yeah, time flies. Time absolutely flies. Crazy, absolutely.
So you certainly split your time between Canada and, let's say, some more obscure countries in the world. Lessons learned, would you say, from the more obscure countries that you can then apply back to your home nation of Canada, or not really?
Oh, Mark, there's no question about it, and I think it all comes down to being open-minded and willing to listen. You know, Canadian First Nations relations should be front and center for our business. And you know, when it comes down to the mining exploration game in particular, explorationists, you know, geologists are your first line whether you're in the jungles of Cambodia or Papua New Guinea or anywhere any remote area in Africa. Oftentimes your geologist and that initial team are the most important first contact points when you're talking with local communities. So everything that I've learned, not being a geologist, excuse me, just to be clear, I'm not a geologist, but being part of that team, because I've always felt it very important to be frontline. I enjoy running companies, and yeah, I'm the finance person and I love the structure of the deal and the markets, et cetera. But I'm also the person who I'm willing to put the backpack on, slug the samples in and out, and do what I can to help the team out. Mm. But those experiences of working with Indigenous communities across the world are applicable. And whether we're talking about the Round Lake communities now for, you know, the context of Romeo's, whether we're talking the Tahltan communities in BC, Round Lake communities in Northwestern Ontario, it's an important part of the dialogue. And so I certainly think that there's much I can apply. Okay. From what I've learned over my career in these far-flung regions of the world that are applicable at home.
Is it harder in more developed countries is it more important in first world countries to engage with First Nations? Is there almost things you can it's very bad saying this, but get away with in other countries that you just cannot get away with in developed countries? Or
I think it's paramount no matter where you are.
Okay.
I think that I don't think that it's fair to apply a priority level of priority one way or the other. I think it's paramount that it just needs to be. Mm-hmm. And perhaps I'm a little bit I'd be deemed naive or a little bit too rose-colored glasses, you know, for lack of a better expression. I believe it's important to engage in those conversations, irregardless of whether or not we have a 20-year relationship on assets or it's a first day in your relationship. First Nations communities, Indigenous communities need to be part of the dialogue, need to be consulted. And in Canada, there's very real rules and regulations and policies and procedures and programs to follow. So you have to do it. So you do it. In the context of an African country or community, it's way more nebulous. That's why I really found it important to bring that with me as part of my team in Uganda. There was two geologists and myself, and then six experts in the social development side of things. We were skewed that way because it was important that we be seen as listening. Mm-hmm. Our business, we don't listen sometimes. And we have shareholders to adhere to, and we want them to be successful. We're fortunate enough to have their dollars and we need to be stewards of these assets and show that we're spending their money wisely. But at the same time, you can't just throw money at things you have to go through those policies, those processes, establish relationships, and grow those relationships so that there's trust. Mm. Because we know, we've seen so much, you know, the Ring of Fire in Ontario. Look at that as an example of an area that's just been unfortunately mishandled time and time again, where, you know, it's an extraordinarily prolific potential, but some of the relationship mandates have just not been handled properly. And with a different approach, maybe things would be different today. I think that applies across the board. So Canada, US, Africa, Southeast Asia, South America for sure as well.
And coming on to Romeos, then, do you feel that you're on top of that? Definitely.
I am learning still. We have the Tall Ten Nation, for example, in British Columbia. There is a process that's been in place way before my time. We've had these assets on the books for tens of years here. So I'm slowly being introduced into the systems. In the case of Round Lake, I have contact points, and I think, you know, I also have, in the context of COVID for us, over this, my short tenure with the company, you know, I only started less than a year ago. It was late September last year when I came on board, and under the context and the circumstances, there's really not been much of an opportunity for me to have any face-to-face, which is something I'm going to rectify as soon as I can, because I think it's really important that you meet the appropriate folks on the other side. But Romeos is, fortunately, and it was part of the conversation early on when I was considering taking on this role, was how does Romeos handle its First Nations and Indigenous community relations? And I was satisfied that it had been done well. So John Bixock, who's my VP of Exploration, has a similar appreciation for it, and he handles himself there very, very well. I'm always impressed with his communications skills and his abilities of, you know, being in the business for 30 years. He's honed the understanding and the importance of those community relations. While I haven't had the opportunity myself to be face to face in these circumstances yet, I look forward to it, and we have open dialogues without a question.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answered your question. I may have gone in circles. Forgive me, Mark. Does that answer your question?
There was a lot of decent information in there, so there was, Stephen. I've done a bit of research in Romeos. I mean, it seems to have been about forever. I'm going to say 25 years, Stephen. Is that
27 to be exact?
27. Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's probably, you know, for a junior explorer to not be renamed. Has it always been called that, or has it had a new,
it has,
new badge? That's weird. It's really weird.
It's an anomaly. There's no question about it. It's not your typical scenario. Longevity in the exploration business is not a common thread. You're either successful or you're not. And then, like you say, it's rebranded, rolled back, restructured, all of these things, and onto a new process. And, you know, Tom Drivis, who's the founder of this company, who founded the company 27 years ago and is our CEO, and chair of the board, he did an extraordinary job of spotting early day opportunities. When I came on board, I keep on trying to find a better term for it, but I can't. Are you guys familiar with, if your car busts, the idea of a barn find? So, you know, your favorite car, let's say it's a 1987 911. You know, that's the one you wanted. You've been looking for it your entire life. You find it in a barn in the middle of a field with 3 inches of dust on it, and it's in perfect nick. You know, that's a barn find. Mm-hmm. And to me, it feels like some of these assets that we have within the company, within Romeos, are barn finds. For example, SCOSA, and we'll get into some of the more fine details around SCOSA. In Nevada-based former producing mine site, we've had it on the books since 1999.
Yeah.
The last time drills turned was in 2006. Now, the results that we had down at SCOSA, which were bonanza great results, that was from a drill program in 2000 when the price of gold was, you know, meandering $400 or $500 an ounce. But we had 3.35 meters of 180 grams per ton gold on our diamond, one of our diamond drill holes. And we had another close to 2 meters of 268 grams per ton gold. And we had a meter and a half of 62 grams gold and 73 grams silver. Extraordinary results. If I came up with those results today, I think the market would pay attention. But the fact that this was an asset that those results now are 22 years ago.
Maybe you should twin the hole, Stephen. Just go back down there again.
Well, this is it. This is it. So we are, and you know, this is going to be a major focus for the company. And part of the reason why I was brought on board was to take a look at the company assets with a fresh set of eyes and make some hard decisions. Because the reality is that we cannot be everything for all assets. You know, across the board right now, we have, I believe, three companies within Romeo's. I think we have assets enough in the Golden Triangle to support a company. We have over 400 square kilometers of claims along the southern boundary of the Galore Creek asset that's co-owned by Teck and Newmont 50-50, and it's one of the largest undeveloped copper gold porphyry targets in the world, series of targets in the world. We have three copper gold porphyry targets of our own, two of which are untested and one of which is having IP shot this week. So I'm very excited, and we can talk about that a little bit in detail. We have another large package of claim blocks in northwestern Ontario that surround Newmont's Musselwhite mine. So that's north of Pickle Lake. And at the end of the day, again, this is a big property, huge potential along the Greenstone Belt. There's only two players. There's Newmont and ourselves. And John Bixock, my VP of Exploration, was one of the senior geologists at the Newmont mine for 15 years, a good portion of his career. So he understands that Greenstone Belt better than most. And then, of course, we've got these two big assets down in Nevada now. And, you know, Mark and Kenny, I think when I look at the company, I see a number of different components to it. I see our structure. I see we have, you know, when you look at our current issued shares, we have 236 million shares outstanding. Fully diluted, we have 262 million shares outstanding. And that number, I think, scares people. Especially when they look at, as you just rightly pointed out, Kenny, this idea that most exploration companies, you know, they have a kick at the can. If they're successful, great. They move on. If they're not, they're restructured, they're repurposed, and a new set of assets are put in. Romeo's has had these three core groups of assets on our books for 20 plus years. And we've spent significant money over those years. I mean, you know, in BC alone, we've spent close to, I think, $18 million on exploration over that period of time. In Ontario, we spent close to $5 million, I would say, on exploration. And then in Nevada, probably the smallest amount of work. And we're going to change that around. So when I was brought on board, and I'm going in circles here, but what the reason why I was brought on board was to figure out how can we structure this company in a way to reintroduce it to the marketplace, because it appears that the market has forgotten about Romeo. So we need to reinvigorate our market. We need to get a healthy trading scenario moving forward. So we have to do something about being able to buy and sell when people want to. That's a healthy market. And my goal is to achieve that this calendar year. To date, we've traded, you know, 50 million shares in the past, you know, 6 months or so. And that pretty much accounts for a similar amount of trading activity in the last 2 years. And a lot of that has gone into safe hands in my network and through into new shareholders that I've been meeting with over the past few months. So that's step one. As far as the total outstanding shares are concerned, you know, we have about 100 million shares sitting in the hands of a very small number of long-term shareholders. So yep. these are folks that have been with us since day one for 27 years. And hey, if you issue 10 million shares a year over 27 years, and that's how you get to your total on issue, it's not that bad actually when you look at it in the big context. Yeah. And at one point we were trading at a dollar and we had a very significant market cap. The assets are still in the company. We just haven't done a lot of telling of a story over the last 10 years, you know. So
to a reason
telling that's it's I don't know the answer exactly, to be honest. I think that for a number of years, there was some work being done and keeping everything in good standing, and maybe the markets weren't as great as they needed to be. And, the management team would raise $1 million just, you know, as needed in order to keep everything in good standing within the systems of Ontario, BC and Nevada. But not a lot of outward communications was taking place. And we have a complex story. I mean, this is back to what I was mentioning. I think we have three companies here. I don't think we have just Romeo's. I think if we can't find strong, significant partners to take on these big assets in BC and in Ontario, then they're prime candidates for spinouts. And I will find a management team to manage it, and we'll finance them individually, and we'll move them all forward, and that all to the benefit of our current shareholder base.
Yep.
You know, I think that's the plan forward, rather than restructuring and rolling back, which I just don't see it working more often than not.
Yeah.
You know, they
260 million shares in the UK. Everybody would be happy with that. I mean, it's not uncommon in the UK, you know, for companies to have a billion and a billion and a half. You know,
this is it exactly. It's context, right?
Yeah.
In the Canadian context, it's got to be a tight structure, 25 million shares, and that's where you're going to get your value creation. You're going to get your value creation by doing real work on real assets that produce real results.
Yep.
And yeah. I'm not going to sit back and be the the bullshit artist who's trying to promote. I'm going to do the real work. I'm going to tell you what I'm doing. I'm going to tell you I did it. I'm going to show the results. And hopefully luck's going to be on our side, because it does take a lot of luck in these cases. A lot of smart people making sure that we're pointing drills in the right direction. But you need a little bit of luck in this business. And I'm hoping that these results are going to help us move forward and start building momentum, because at 3.5 cents, as we are trading today on minimal volume, I'm certainly an active buyer and will continue to be at these levels, because I think the assets haven't changed. We were trading at $1 worth of value 10 years ago. And if anything, we've just added more information to the assets, better understanding, more drill results, and new assets to the grouping. And of course, we have some great partnerships as well, which some people often say are an equivalent in market value just in the partnership. So, you know, we've got somewhere between $3 and $3.2 million of cash and securities in the bank, marketable securities. So as our market cap stands right now, we've got almost 40% of our value just sitting in cash in securities. And then we've got serious positions in the Golden Triangle with three copper gold porphyry targets, Northwestern Ontario, surrounding the Musselwhite mine with some of the best drill intercepts that have been seen outside of the Musselwhite mine results. And then two assets in Nevada, which I think are extraordinary. And at the end of the day, Nevada is going to be our priority and our focus, because it's relatively inexpensive to operate in Nevada vis-a-vis the costs of associated helicopter supported exploration and drilling in the Golden Triangle. It's a game we can't afford.
I mean, they're all tier one, mining jurisdictions, but especially in Nevada, you know, there's so much going on. There's so many majors. I mean, I think, is that number one in the Fraser Institute from memory, or in the top three anyway? I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And they're in one of the top gold producers in the world now. And they've got a government system that's very supportive of the further development of mines. You know, that's key. They're willing to permit. They want to see the development of assets. They're being smart about it from an environmental perspective. They're being very judicious and appropriate in the way in which they are achieving that. But as long as you work within the system, I think Nevada is an extraordinary place to work. And we happen to have some really, really cool assets to talk about.
Yeah, well, let's just focus on Nevada. I mean, I know you've mentioned Ontario and obviously BC, and you can come on again and talk about these. But I think, you know, we've been talking for over half an hour now, so maybe just give us time flies. Honestly, it does in this podcast.
Sure, it does.
you know, just give us, you know, 6-7 minutes in each of those two projects in Nevada that you're focused on, and
no problem.
You know, and just the investment opportunity for, you know, anyone that's listening that's thinking, well, this company's got, you know, 40% of its value in cash right away, you know, and it's been, you know, it's 90-something% down from 10 years ago. You know, there is an opportunity here. So
that's right. So one of the core assets in Nevada is called the Kincaid Project. And I brought this to the company in November. It was something that I had been looking at previous to joining the team at Romeo's. And I felt it was a perfect match for when I saw SCOSA, which is that former producing mine site I mentioned earlier, and I'll give you a little details in a moment. It was a great match. And if we were going to focus on Nevada, I thought having a early stage greenfields opportunity, early stage opportunity like Kincaid, married against something that was, you know, former producer, drill ready, permitted, ready to go in SCOSA, that was a great match. So Kincaid is in the southwestern quadrant of the state. It's in what's called the Walker Lane, and it's just outside of Hawthorne by about 15 kilometers due east. And we picked up 109 claims in total, covering about 2,000 plus acres. And, you know, it's accessible. So as I mentioned previously, I mean, you fly in, fly out in BC, you fly in and fly out in Ontario. Here you drive to your property, and there's a highway that is a kilometer from the base of the claim block, and you can drive your four-wheel drive machines all throughout the property, and it's exciting. There's, you know, I've been to property back in April, and you know, to date we've identified dozens of targets. When we first approached and did a deal on the first nine claims, we did so with a local geologist, and it was over top of two former producing mines that are on the property. One's called the Montreal Gold Silver Mine, and the other is the Montreal Silver Mine. And you know, we were excited by that potential. And then as we started to explore north and south, we quickly realized that there's dozens of old mine workings and prospects and pits and trenches. And the first program down on the project area was in November. And John Bixock came back with this big smile on his face. And he's like, you wouldn't believe what we've seen. And it's interesting in Nevada, very quickly, you know, there's no continuity of sharing of data. Not like in Canada, where you have to file reports, you have to file your work programs, you have to show what you did in order to keep things in good standing. In Nevada, you pay your money, you keep everything in good standing from a finance perspective, but you don't have to share your data. So there's no continuity of who's worked on this project over the last 100 years. There's pits that we have identified that, you know, that have multiple tags showing that they've been sampled by various companies over the decades, but we have no idea who did the work. Yeah. We have no idea why they chose this one spot, because there's no continuity of big exploration work. So Kincaid is proving it to be very exciting. Some of the results that were the high grade results that we've recently announced in the southern half is our main focus. You know, we actually staked the property originally because of the northern half. The northern half is the skarn model that's very similar to operating mine due east of us called the Isabella Pearl. And their model is exactly structurally what we are expecting to look at as far as the northern half of the property is concerned. The southern half was a surprise to us. And as we've explored the southern half of the Kincaid project and the property, we've seen these unbelievable surface showings, and it's not what we expect. You know, we might find an adit listed on an old map from 50, 60 years ago, and it says, you know, they were mining narrow quartz and coarse veins with gold. When you get to that adit, you end up finding a 4 meter wide garnet skarn that runs for 200 meters. You know, these are big systems. Yeah. Nowhere on any map do you see that. So we're excited. You know, some of the surface sampling that we've done, is recently announced, you know, high grade on the copper, on grab samples. Forgive me, there's obviously no drilling that's been done. These are all surface grab samples. You know, 7+% copper. We've seen 30+ grams per ton gold on samples. We've seen 55-ounce silver samples. But there's a continuity to the southern half of the property that is really exciting, in that we're seeing that rich copper staining, that green staining, that blue staining across the board. So if we find an adit, oftentimes they were marked as barite mines. So most of what we have found to date isn't listed on any map. So it's former operating mines, former test pits and trenches. There's always seems to be a pile of green stained or blue stained, copper stained material at the opening. So, and within these adits, you can see that the copper veining throughout, but there's all the pile. And from our results that we've seen so far, we're seeing copper running with gold or copper running with silver. And now we need to do that basic work, that basic mapping and sampling, you know, the hyperspectral surveys and the other works, in an effort to determine, you know, the nature of this mineralization event. You know, where is the greatest potential? Why is it that we are seeing so many surface expressions? And what is it that we're looking at depth? Only through that basic exploration work and that we need to do immediately. And only once we're completed that will we have a better sense and be able to get to a point where we're looking at drill targets. But the surface results are extraordinary. This has quickly become a copper-focused story for us. Mm-hmm. But it's not just copper. It's running high-grade gold. It's running high-grade silver. And now we need to figure out what's happening underground, because at surface, it's exciting. And then, of course, we have the entire potential to the north. And on our two programs that we've been on site for so far, we've probably only looked at about 40% of the entire property. I think that's even maybe being generous. And we've found all of these targets already. So we have a lot of work to do. We have money in the bank to do this work. And we're very excited by the potential, because some of these grades are just extraordinary, and your listeners can go onto our website and see some of the recent press releases, because it's really quite exciting. And just as a side note, there is a new website coming. Our website is in dire need of a facelift, and hopefully by the end of this month we'll have that taken care of. But the second property, I mean, if you would like to ask any questions about Kincaid, I'd happily to answer some of them.
Yeah, I was just, I mean, I looked through your RNSs for the last 6 months, and, you know, it's all been, as you say, high grade, grab samples from the surface. So it certainly looks consistent. And obviously that kind of exploration is cheap and cheerful. You know, you're not need to put a lot of dollars into the ground to get a picture of what's going on. It's definitely interesting, but I mean, I know you're going to come on to the Scosa gold project, and I'll let you speak about it first, but there's one page in the presentation I want to talk about that just jumped out at me, so it did, but I'll keep that until you've given us an overview.
Scosa is one of these assets that I think most companies would scammer to have, like would love to have. You've got a former producing mine on site. When they were in production in the 30s and early 40s, they were producing, or they were pulling 1 ounce plus per ton gold out of the ground. In fact, some of the cases from the old timers' accounts, the gold was so rich that the ore wasn't processed; it was taken and put directly into the vault at Lovelock. And in that, if you go to Lovelock, the museum, the mining museum there, there were some specimens of that high grade, high concentration. Great gold that came out of Scosa. And Scosa was one of those assets that put Nevada back on the map. As I've done my research looking through the old history books, Scosa brought Nevada back onto the front page for gold mining back in the early 30s. They were finding wire gold at surface. And so we have this asset on our books since 1999. We've done some programs on it. We've done a little bit of diamond drilling, as I mentioned, you know, 3.35 meters of 180 grams per ton. I mean, that's an extraordinary intercept. And that was drilled in 2000, so 22 years ago. Yeah. And we haven't put a drill rig back since 2006. Now, the idea there is that in 2004 and 2006, there was some RC drilling done. They were quite deep, the holes. And the model was, okay, so if we're going to go, let's see how deep we get them, go 600-700 meters down and see if we intercept those veins. And they did, but they weren't mineralized. So, with the luxury of time and analysis of all of the regional plays, what we're looking at now is identifying something called the boiling zone. And that boiling zone is, there's very, very specific type of material you find at in a boiling zone. It's this tabular quartz material that when you see it, you understand that it's very indicative. And what happens is that the fluids come up and forgive me again, I'm not a geologist. I try and keep it simple. You know, the fluids come to serve or as they're coming towards surface, they hit a certain point where the pressure changes. And as that pressure changes, it boils and the gold and the silver precipitate out. And they come into concentration, and that concentration creates these verticals of highly concentrated areas of gold and silver. And we believe that that's what SCOSA is. So we're going to get back to SCOSA this year. We're going to drill a fence of holes up the side of the hill, and we're going to try and intercept that boiling zone. Now, when they originally were mining at SCOSA, they only mined down 400 feet. Models of the SCOSA or of this boiling zone model typically are 1,000 feet, even up towards the 1,500 feet of vertical mineralization. So we're quite confident, especially given our historic drill results, that we are going to be able to intercept that high grade material again. Mm-hmm. But this is something that's going to take a little bit of time and work, because we have our ongoing work programs for the summer in BC on our BC assets, because that window was so tight, July to August, and that's it. And then the snow flies again. So this work in Nevada is going to start in September and run through till the end of the year.
Excellent. Yeah. Sorry.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, that's a quick snapshot. I mean, I could get into the grades and the material and so on, but that's really.
Yeah. We'll keep that for another podcast or an interview, Stephen. But I mean, there's something I just want to point out to people that are listening at the moment. So there's a lot of presentations on your website, and the one that I downloaded for the Nevada projects is 53 pages. And I kind of thought, oh no, this is going to take forever to get through. But I mean, it's an easy read. But you get to page 46 of the presentation, and there's a statement that says, the Sleeper Mine, this is for the SCOSA Gold Project, the Sleeper Mine produced 500,000 ounces of gold from a vein 1 foot wide, 140 foot long, and 70 foot high. And I've read that about 5 or 6 times, and maybe it's 50,000 ounces of gold. Maybe it's just a typo. It's not a typo.
So the Sleeper Mine is due north of us by, I think, 75 kilometers or so, maybe 100 kilometers. And the Sleeper Mine is a fabled mine in Nevada, because it had this high grade colloidal gold ore. And, if you do download that presentation, you'll see a picture of what it looks like. That material was so rich that it had that it produced 500,000 ounces in that small vein area. The gold that was produced out of SCOSA that was pulled out was that rich. It was over an ounce per ton and plus. So, there's every reason to think that we should be able to find more. But it's, we need to do the work now. We need to get the drill rig back. But that's exactly the example of why it has excitement in my eyes, because the regionally speaking in northwestern Nevada, there are examples of this high grade material coming out of the ground. And we know historically that SCOSA had that as well.
Yeah, and there's some cracking pictures in that presentation as well. I'm just looking at them while you were talking there. I know it sounds quite daunting, a 53 page presentation, but it's not that bad. You soon get into it, so you do. Actually, I prefer that. I'd rather have too much information than too little.
Well, Kenny, that's why it's there. When I do a presentation with investors, I keep it to 20 minutes and 25 slides max. And if they're interested in getting into the details of all of the different targets that we have identified and the reasoning behind it, you can't do that in an elevator pitch. That's why I put that presentation online, is dive deep and then come back with questions.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, I'm going to have a look at it again. But Mark, again, sorry, I'm talking too much. I'll let you jump in before we maybe finish off, because we're coming up in an hour, which is it's just flying in.
Yeah. No, I'm happy. I was listening there, and it's all sounds good to me. So I've got a good snapshot there.
Yeah. What about the 60-second challenge? Should we put them in the spot, Mark?
If we can manage 60 seconds, that's probably literally all I've got left. I am rushing out the door in about less than 60 seconds. But yeah, go on then. 60 seconds, Stephen. I'm going to put you on the spot. 60 seconds in which to make a pitch, an elevator pitch for the company, why people should invest in Romney's gold. So you can start in 3, 2, 1, and off you go.
I think that the company's got assets that are well beyond their level right now. I think that three companies could be easily seeded with extraordinary assets through spinouts. If we can't find strong partners to take on the BC and Ontario assets, I think our market capitalization is sitting around $8 million with $3.5 million in the bank in cash and securities. Is a strong indication of we're not getting value for these assets currently. So I hope taking all that into account, that some of your listeners consider a position in Romeo's Gold.
Yeah, 45 seconds. Well done. There we go. I'm impressed considering how you were talking before. I thought that might be a bit of a challenge, but no, well done. I think that summed it up very well. So. Yeah, there's more we can talk about, clearly, isn't there, Kenny? There's a lot. Yeah. We can go into a lot of detail here. I think, are you on the Stopbox premiere in there next week?
Yes, we are. Yes, yeah. That's right.
Okay.
So, I'm very much looking forward to diving deeper into the Nevada assets.
Sure. Yeah, well, that's the focus. Then we'll focus a lot on those assets. But, I mean, we can do a number of premieres or a number of podcasts, really, I think, diving deep into all the projects that you have in the portfolio. As you said, you've almost got three companies in one, so... I think as a high-level overview here to really just whet people's appetite, if we have put 56 minutes or so, I think you did a pretty decent job.
Well, I appreciate the time today, guys. It was a fun conversation. I tend to talk when given the opportunity, so I enjoyed it. For my first podcast, I really enjoyed it.
Good. Excellent. Okay.
Perfect. All right, well, thanks for your time anyway, Stephen, and I'm sure we'll catch up pretty soon. Next week.
Next week.
I'm looking forward to next week as well. Excellent. Have a great day, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.